Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast. That mystery voice was our guest, Mark Hannam. But I should introduce myself. I'm Thomas WP, a part-time, A-level mostly physics teacher, and I'm joined by Robin Griffiths.
Yes, hello. I'm a sort of A-level and, you know, other things physics teacher-ish, so I teach physics at all ages, which is good.
So, Mark, welcome to the podcast. You probably should introduce yourself and tell people why we brought you on the show.
Well, first, let me say thank you for having me. It's amazing to be on your show. My name is Mark Hannam, and I am the K-12 Program Manager at the American Association of Physics Teachers.
You're going to have to explain to a numpty like me what K-12 means.
K-12, yes, one of those specific terms for the states. So K-12 meaning kindergarten through grade 12. Okay. So I manage all of the programs in outreach and professional development programs that the American Association of Physics Teachers has that specifically targets teachers who are teaching physics and physical science concepts from kindergarten all the way through grade 12.
How old do they turn in grade 12?
18.
So K-12 would be our primary and secondary education in the UK, so from 5-year-olds through to 18-year-olds. So, Robin, that's quite similar to you. You looked after the teachers who were looking after kids in that range. I'm kind of going to take a step back and let you two chat about working on the other side of the fence from the teachers.
Yeah, it's really – I'm fascinated, Mark, actually, because, you know, I was first things first, you're in charge or you have responsibility, if you like, for continuing professional development for physics teachers in America. So if I'm an American physics teacher, what could I expect from the AAPT in terms of professional development?
So we offer kind of a wide variety of experiences. So we have kind of large initiatives around things like quantum computing, climate change, physics of life. We also have a lot of programs in diversity, equity, and inclusion. We also look at physics teacher preparation, as well as kind of newer trends, such as trying to bring in computation into physics classes. And that kind of trickles down in lots of different ways, from local professional development to regional to – we also have a twice a year annual meetings where we bring together, you know, teachers and researchers, physics education researchers together to talk about the best practices of teaching of physics. And that's actually one of the other things that's important to mention about AAPT is that it has a very unique position in that I am the K-12 program manager, but we also have someone that's in charge of university and higher ed teacher preparation, but also physics education research and graduate schools and, you know, people pursuing PhDs. So we span, you know, the full kind of educational spectrum. So we try to have meetings where we bring all these people together to really talk about what are the best things to do as far as teaching of physics.
That's really interesting because I think in the UK, and I don't know, Thomas, if you bear me out here, but professional development for teachers very much emphasizes what I call, and I don't mean to be dismissive about this, but generic skills that teachers have. So it's things like classroom management, behavior, these sorts of things. Whereas your professional development really seems to be focused in on the subject, the developments in the subject, how to develop your teaching of the subject. That's a real difference, I think.
Yeah, it's been an interesting kind of historical perspective. You know, AAPT was started in the 1930s. And initially it was, you know, much more about university level physics research and physics teaching. And over the years, it really kind of developed into this idea that, you know, to improve the quality of what was going on in college and university, we really had to think what came before that. And I think much to our benefit, the kind of higher ed institution started to take ownership of what was going on in the secondary and primary schools and really say that we have to build kind of a top to bottom approach.
Hmm. So the universities and the colleges, I should say, got themselves involved and they said, okay, we need to create a dialogue with the schools in order to make sure that there's a seamless link, if you like, between school level and university level.
Absolutely. And this is probably a biased opinion, but I think the physics community does that much better than, say, the chemistry or the biology or any of the other, or even math, in that there are much bigger separations between the higher education community and the secondary and primary communities.
Well, that's a real interesting lesson I think we could take over here, isn't it? That that's a success for physics in the US, and it shows that tight relationship between what we call tertiary education here in the UK, further education, universities, colleges, and beyond, can be brought into schools to make a difference. That's really a handy tip, I think.
Yeah, it's really one of the more entertaining parts of my job is I get to work with a lot of high school teachers, but I also get to work with a lot of people that are looking into physics education research from the higher education side and really trying to combine those two worlds.
I hate to bring it down to this level, but it is one of the constant bugbears here with professional development programs. What about your funding? Where does the money come from for this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the funding comes from two places. One, we get a lot of money from the federal government, from the National Science Foundation, to run these types of professional development programs that connects in particular the kind of research that's being done at higher education institutions to what is done in classrooms, and really trying to focus on only doing research tested or research validated teaching approaches. But we also, have dues. So people are paying membership dues to be a part of our community. And then we try to recycle those dues back into professional development opportunities. We also publish two journals, one that is on the teaching of physics, particularly in the kind of upper high school, early secondary, but also we have a more traditional physics research journal that we publish.
Can I ask a question? You do outreach for physics teachers. Would that be a day at the weekend for people to come to, which has geographical challenges in America, or is it going into individual schools in the week? How does that work?
It's more of outside of school activities where we try to have kind of local or regional affiliates. So, for example, I work at the national AAPT office, but we also have state level organizations. The AAPT of Maryland or the AAPT of Massachusetts. And those state level organizations really try to organize things on regional levels or even, city level levels, trying to help teachers, as you said, on the weekends or after school.
That would be like our Dulwich Day and Speed, wouldn't it, Robin?
Yeah, similar things. And those are set up and run by the Institute of Physics, which has a mixture of funding from government and, again, from the Institute itself, which is membership funded and funded by the journals that the Institute of Physics produces more widely, the sort of specialist journals, specialist physics scientific journals for academics, which sort of provide the IOP with a lot of their funding. So, Mark, can I just ask, how many members do you have? How many American physics teachers are there?
So, that's a good question. So, as I was going to ask you this too, because I'm very curious of the scale of difference. So, we estimate to be about 27,000 teachers of physics in the States.
Right.
And when we say teachers of physics, we don't necessarily mean full-time teachers, right? These are people that at some point in their teaching day teach a single class of physics. So only about half of those are what we consider to be full-time physics teachers, where they're spending their entire day teaching physics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, so that's it's interesting. In the UK, I think we have this slight wrinkle here in that teachers tend to be identified as science teachers rather than the individual speciality. So Thomas, for example, I think may be a science teacher with a physics specialism. That's typically how people are employed. But I think in total, the rough figure we tend to work to is that there are about 30,000 science teachers, of which 10,000 should be physics teachers by rights, but it's actually nearer, I think, five. I can't remember, but it's a lower, much lower figure than that. So it's a shortage. And Mark, I wanted to ask you that in terms of, having talked to our good friend of the podcast, Patrick Kaplow, who no doubt you know, because, you know, America's a small place, So you must know him.
You're both on the same coast, aren't you? I mean, it's pretty close.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He just lives down the beach. Exactly. A bit, yeah.
Just down the beach. Easy drive.
Yeah. And but Patrick was saying that sort of the physics teacher shortage is an acute issue in the States. Is it the case?
It is. It actually seems like about similar numbers. Our statistics try to predict somewhere between 35% and 40% of high school graduates take a physics class. So that, you know, 60% of the country never takes a physics class before they graduate high school.
That's such a shame, isn't it? It's a wasted opportunity and such a missed opportunity. But it is interesting. I don't know whether to be depressed or reassured that we both countries experience the same sort of problem. In a way, it is a validation of the fact that there are so many different things that physicists are drawn to doing that there is a shortage of people left over in the pool to teach. But on the other hand, you feel that it should be a subject that gets a higher profile, particularly because you mentioned earlier on the outreach that you do in terms of keeping physics teachers up to date with things like global warming and computational physics and all these sorts of things. These are big areas, aren't they? Big areas of skill.
They are. And really what is a very large concern of ours is that, you know, if those are the statistics about who is taking physics in this country, but then we compare that to the number of undergraduate degrees in physics that U.S. universities are conferring, it turns out that the number of degrees is going up. In fact, it's almost doubled in the last 20 years, which is great news. But what that means is that you're getting a bigger gap between the people that have had physics and enjoy physics and are studying physics and can use physics, and then people that have not had the opportunity. And that's one of the reasons why we're really focused on, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion issues about trying to expand the opportunities for students to experience physics sometime in their secondary or primary schooling.
And how's that going in terms of optional physics? Do you find that there's a quite a skewed gender bias?
So it turns out that if you look at the people that are taking physics in high school, that it's about a 50-50 ratio, which is great. The problem is that that's such a subset of the total population. Now, we then see a large drop-off as we look at as students pass from high school into university. And then it drops down more to about 20% women, which is a problem, which is one of the reasons why we have a really great program that we're very proud of, which is something called the Step Up program, stepupphysics.com, if you're interested. And it's really about providing high school teachers with really nice research-tested lessons about how to address, how to encourage women into physics by showing them what are the different jobs you can pursue with a physics background, not just being a physics researcher or a physics teacher, but also very directly addressing kind of unconscious bias that women and other minorities feel inside the physics community. And those have been very successful.
That's superb, because that sounds really good. I think Step Up Physics, Thomas, wasn't that mentioned when we talked to who'd been on Fox News?
Moses.
Moses Rifkin, yeah.
Moses is a good friend of Step Up Physics.
So is Step Up an AAPT thing?
It is. It's actually a joint collaboration between AAPT and then the American Physical Society, which is kind of the more kind of pure physics research community, although they do have some education programs. And then two U.S. universities that are – the four institutions are all working together to really try to attack this problem.
It sounds very similar, actually, Mark, to much of the work that the IAP is doing here in terms of trying to address that stubborn. Because we have a stubborn sort of 23% at A level, which is where students get to effectively choose to narrow down their subjects to a mere 3 or 4. There's a big drop off there, and stubbornly that figure has remained at about 23% for a good 15, 20 years, despite everybody's best efforts. But some recent work on unconscious bias and things like that has certainly had some traction. So we're hoping that in future, earlier, you know, as the years play out, that we'll see that starting to be addressed. And it's really good to see also a lot of those lessons that you were talking about things like highlighting the successes of female physicists and highlighting the great range of careers that are available to physicists, the success that's had. So that's good to hear that those sorts of things are happening in parallel at either side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's something that we're excited about, and we're really looking to expand it. And in fact, for your larger UK listeners, we're even considering having international step-up programs.
Oh, excellent. So that's good. Well, I was going to ask about this, about in terms of international, you know, hands across the ocean and all that sort of thing. But can you be a member of the American Association of Physics Teachers and be based in the UK?
You absolutely can. We have many international members.
Oh, fantastic. So there we go, everybody. Dear listener, if you are listening, see if you can't get yourself. And actually, I have to say that I have raided your website on a number of occasions for some really, really wonderful research-led resources that you can use for teaching, and a lot of the work on diagnostic questioning, which is so exciting in physics at the moment, that's led by you guys, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. We try to be the hub of information, and there's a lot of people working on it that aren't necessarily working at AAPT, but a lot of our partners in higher ed, in the K-12 realm, and we try to be kind of the nexus of information and consolidate a lot of that knowledge and that research.
Now, Thomas and I are obviously, you know, the Physics Teaching Podcast is going on its inaugural world tour later in the year. So we're off to speak at Boston. Now, that's the NSTA, which is the National Science Teachers Association. Now, that presumably is a slightly different organization again.
It is. That organization is a little bit broader in its focus. You know, it has teachers of science that includes obviously physics, chemistry, biology, earth science, space science, but also has probably a larger membership in the earlier grades than we do.
I was wondering if you've been to one of their conferences and can give us a few tips and tell us what to expect.
Oh, yeah, they're good conferences. They're very large. There lots of people attend, and it's a great place to meet people and to kind of talk about the issues that you have and the excitement that you bring to your classrooms. It is often difficult to navigate because there's so many things going on.
Right. Okay. So spend some time with the program beforehand so that we can make sure we make the most of it.
Yes. That's a big suggestion. It's definitely look through the program and see, you know, what are all the options.
And in terms of wowing our audience, obviously, when we're there, so there'll be a mixture of scientists there. So there could be anything from geologists through to biologists. So no big words, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
That's getting cut. Oh, I'm just kidding.
So will it be people from teaching at kindergarten right through?
Yes, absolutely.
Lovely.
In fact, that might be the majority of the population is the younger grades, and then it kind of levels off as you get older.
That's good. Interesting. So that's good. That tells us a bit about our audience. That's good to know. So we have to come up with a something that's appealing to secondary biology teachers and kindergarten science teachers, Thomas. That'll be
vacuum cannon all day.
Small children be fired across the lab by the vacuum cannon. Excellent. Physics lives.
I will. Another important difference between, I think, education in the UK and in the United States is that because education is primarily a state level action, there's no really federal oversight. The rules about safety in classroom are also more disaggregated. So the idea of a vacuum cannon in a kindergarten classroom could be perfectly fine in one state, and you just have to find the right people to talk to.
Well, we've climbed through all the hoops for health and safety for our presentation, so I think we've been allowed to use the vacuum cannon. So we'll firing that up. I'm not sure many kindergartens have a vacuum pump. I wanted to ask you before we talked about Boston. What would a day look like that the AAPT, imagine I'm a teacher living in, say, Windham, New Hampshire, and there's a conference going on in Boston. What sure. sort of thing are you running for these teachers?
So it runs kind of two different things. One, we have practical level workshops where they're more intensive. They're maybe 3 or 4 hours long, where we ask teachers to come in and really not just hear or learn about something, but get their hands dirty and experience it themselves. So that could be doing a lab practical, that could be looking at an assessment practice, that could be doing a coding workshop on how to integrate computational models into what you teach. And then we also have more kind of the standard science research talk, where we have people come in with their PowerPoint presentations, and they share either an innovative approach they're using in their classroom, or if it's one of our university members, they're sharing some of their educational research and what they've discovered and how that trickles down into a practical application.
So that's very different to the days I've been to with the IOP. Do the IOP do that sort of hands-on practical stuff?
Okay. They do from time to time. The difficulty with IOP is that they're often sort of piggybacking on the goodwill of schools, and they're often using weekend labs at weekends and things like that. So actually getting technician support, things like that, can be quite difficult. So sometimes it's a little bit challenging to get practical work done. But nonetheless, there are some excellent practical sessions that go on. For example, looking through, and because we have so many non-specialist physics teachers, for example, the core practicals, the set of practicals that are on exam board at 16, have sort of dictated that all kids should do in physics. There's guidance sessions on those for non-specialists and even for specialists, I guess, who are looking at those for the first time, how to use the equipment, how to get the best results out of them. So there are practically focused sessions, but there are also a lot of sessions that focus on how one might teach. But most of the coaches at IOP I talked to were very keen to get some practical element into all of their sessions, because they wanted to emphasize that physics was first and foremost a practical subject, you know, as you always tell us, Thomas.
Certainly is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a great practical today, actually. I'm doing inverse square law, and obviously it's a bit tricky if you're using the sources, like gamma. You have to keep an eye on that, and you've got 16 people in this little class. And the last few years, I've been doing a carousel, Robin, of inverse square law practicals. So they have to tell if the inverse square law applies to light, with a little rolled up bit of black paper with a light at the end of the light sensor, magnetic fields. And I just have a lump of iron on some scales and some pieces of cardboard. They have to measure with a micrometer to get the thickness and shove, pull them out one after the other, and the attractive force goes down and that changes. And then sound with a huge speaker pointing upwards. That's interesting, because you know, some do, some don't, and then that's an interesting thing, because you'd think sound would be, but sound doesn't.
With 16 of them doing it in one classroom.
Well, for little groups of four, and then I kind of stand by the radiation and get them doing that, so they're safe, and then the others just quietly get on with it. They're pretty well trained up by now. This is the oldest kids in the school.
Doesn't it get quite busy in there? Must be a bit like Piccadilly Carousel at some stage, doesn't it? I would have thought. But I didn't think it should turn into a three-ring carousel or anything. I think it must just be. I've got loads of these. I wrote loads down last night.
It's not a circus. It's not a circus. They have 25 minutes, Robin. They're calm and disciplined.
Calm carousel.
So talking of practicals, or labs, as you would call them, Mark, do you have a favourite lab that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it, and I think one of my favorite labs or experiences for students is a really basic one, which is projectile motion. And this is usually something that I did fairly early on in the year, after they had a fair grasp of kinematics, and something as simple as you know, rolling a ball off a table and predicting where it lands by putting a cup on the ground. And not a complicated setup, but I think the best thing is watching their faces as they can make this prediction. And I think it really turns a light on when they say, wow, physics works. And it's not so much that the process was so illuminating in that, oh, understanding projectile motion is so much deeper, but rather I think it proves to them relatively early on in the year that what we're about to study is practical. It does describe something real, and it's not just equations and numbers on a page.
So that would be a curved ramp of card or something ending horizontally at the edge of the table, and you're taking the kinetic energy of the height of the ball and turning that into velocity as it leaves the table and then predicting where to put a cup. Is that right?
Actually, even we do this so early on before we study energy transfer. So usually we just put a couple of photo gates at the end of it, and it just reads off the initial speed.
So that gives you the speed, and then they can predict where to put it, right? Because we've had a advanced version of this from Patrick Kaplow, which he calls slice the pendulum, which so this ties in pretty well with that. So slice the pendulum, he hangs a pendulum back on cotton and then swings it, and it gets sliced as it reaches vertical. And then they had to predict where the cup is. And that is much more energy to energy to kinematics. So yours is much more, you know, much more accessible, isn't it? If it's much earlier in the course, I like it.
It is. Now we also have developed a more advanced version of it, which is, I think, a pretty significant least a big step forward from that, which is we lately have been trying really hard to integrate more computation into our course and what we're teaching, particularly for our advanced AP level course. So these are second year physics students that are a little bit better at things. And we decided that we wanted them to kind of numerically model air drag. And it was a big jump. So we had this little kind of spring-loaded ball launcher that was fitted with kind of a hard plastic ball. And we found some very light styrofoam balls of about the same size. So because they were so light, the air drag forces on it were much, much bigger. So we designed a long kind of investigative process, something that took several weeks, where the students had to first characterize the drag force on their little styrofoam ball. And they did that by dropping it off a two-story kind of walkway in our school. And we used video analysis, and we extracted the position time, and then we did some numerical derivatives to get acceleration as a function of velocity. And then we took that and we put that into kind of a basic kinematic expression, the same equations that we used for before, but then we asked them to think about kind of tiny time steps where there was a variable acceleration in a normal kinematic expression, and to then predict where a projectile would land under the influences of a very strong drag force.
Nice.
This is where we lose out so badly at, because we have to teach what we're told. There's the national curriculum, and then there's the specifications for A level. You just can't do a long explorative piece of work like that. I'm so envious. Wouldn't that be fun, Robin?
Just I know. I was just
thinking, chase that down and introduce a bit of coding and.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be fantastic. And I remember a good friend of ours, Tim Hardigan, would do this with simple harmonic motion, using tiny time increments and using the very basic formulae for things like Hooke's law and so on and so forth to build up a picture of why you get simple harmonic oscillation. But it was just a very quick aside that he used to do. But exploring it in depth and looking at that and thinking about what time derivatives mean and things like that, that'd be great.
Yeah, he told us about it on the podcast last year, and I went away and actually did the spreadsheet and used it. And it's brilliant. You build it up with logical steps of what they understand from kinematics, and it gives you a perfect sine wave. It's just lovely, and you can just do it in Excel, just step by step.
Yeah,
and we'll put a link in the show notes because he did send us his original spreadsheet. Cool. If people want to try that, and that is on that the Rev that was called. I can't remember which episode it was. The Rev.
This Mark, by the way, is just a colleague, a former colleague of both of ours. We both worked with him, and I hope he won't mind me saying this, but he's in his 70th year now and still going strong teaching physics. And he's also a Church of England vicar as well, because, you know, as you do, I'm sure you have loads in the AAPT.
I don't have those statistics on hand.
He's also 6'6" and is really thin and wears a brown leather jacket with a dog collar when he's walking through the school corridors. He is something else. Just a brilliant teacher, brilliant physicist. And he is the person who knows all the practicals. He's just excellent.
I'm sure you must have characters like that in the AAPT. There's people who just have this wealth of knowledge who you just hope you could just empty their brain and put it into a library somewhere. It would be great.
Absolutely. You know, it's And that's one of the things that we try really hard is, and I think this is in listening to your, some of your other podcasts, and I think even the reason for your podcast, which is about building up community and connecting people, physics teachers in particular, or teachers of physics that are kind of isolated. And one of the roles of AAPT is to really try to build those communities and bring people together and to show the characters that exist in this field, but also to learn from each other.
And it's one of the really lovely things actually has been the fact that, that even from very early stages, the number of American physics teachers who are now tuned in and are listening, there's a real sense of that community. And we've had so many great ideas that, that have flipped across the Atlantic between the two communities. So I'm sincerely hoping in future that this might sort of grow and become maybe an exchange program. I'm just saying, you know, if there's a place in Hawaii, San Diego, Florida, sure. Keys, that sort of thing, I'm you know, willing, because I'm that kind of guy.
To the Keys. Yeah. You know, Keys would be fine. Hawaii, sure. Fine.
Sure.
No, but I think it is a lovely thing, and it's a lovely that it's managed to fill a little bit of a gap in that sense of community. And I think, you know, when we go to the NSTA, that's what we'll be talking about and saying, you know, if you do feel, you know, occasionally a little bit professionally isolated, the great thing about the current world, the social media, the fact you can download a podcast, you know, you're only a couple of clicks away from a friendly physics voice or a friendly physics email to get you through and to give you some advice.
Yes, you are. And I was going to say that, you know, the community is outstanding. We were a bit sad last week that we had no one had given us any tips for teaching momentum, and we hadn't tweeted about it. Well, we sent out a tweet, and the response has been excellent. Yeah. So we're building up to an episode on teaching momentum. I did retweet a teacher who I'm hoping to get on the podcast when we do it, who, to teach momentum, takes his kids to the gym, puts down a mat, holds a mat, and gets them to run at him. You watched the video on the Twitter thread. So I'm looking forward to seeing Dr. D. Farmer, Dave Farmer, or having him on the podcast. You should look up his video. I'll link to it in the show notes.
So I have a question for you, because this is a question that we are discussing, you know, in AAPT, which is about momentum, which is there benefits to teaching the concepts of momentum and energy before you go into forces and dynamics? Or do you have to do, you know, the forces first and then go into energy and momentum?
Hmm.
Oh, that's a really good question. Personally, I prefer to take momentum before I take forces, because in our specifications and in physics, in Principia, we mentioned last week, force is the rate of change of momentum. And if you introduce force and then say, oh, yes, and it's also rate of change of momentum, and you haven't had a thorough go at momentum, it doesn't make sense. And then they'll just remember F equals MA. But if you do momentum first, and they understand mass and they understand velocity, and everyone innately understands momentum, don't they? They know who to stand in front of if a big bloke is running towards them fast and a little child is toddling towards them. They know who to stand in front of them. We all innately understand it. If you can then teach them which is quite theoretically challenging, then when they get onto forces, rate change momentum, it makes more sense. So I would be with the momentum first.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I can see why it's evolved to be forces first, because it's deemed to be that kids are much more familiar with speed, and if you're going to teach them speed, then you teach them acceleration, and if you're going to teach them acceleration, that's a good way into forces, and then you tackle momentum. But I think intuitively, in terms of physics, you think about forces much more constructively if you think about them as the rate of change of momentum. That's a far more useful model for me.
Yeah, I would agree with the two of you, but that's not necessarily how the majority of teaching in the United States is done.
Or in the UK, absolutely.
Well, it's that Newton's second law is F equals MA. It's a trap, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, so I think I think I can see a virtue for both. So in the way, you know, if I had my wish list, would I teach? Yeah, I'd teach momentum first, I think. I think I'd start with that concept of, you know, a force changes. And I talk about momentum, and I've said this before on the podcast, but I talk about momentum in terms of being the quantity of motion that exists in an object. And that's what I call it. Momentum is the measure of motion. And, you know, a force changes the quantity of an object's motion. And that's a much more useful way of building up the understanding. And from there, you can go to, well, of course, smaller objects accelerate more under the same force than larger objects. That's a much more intuitive step from that point, I think. But you're right, it's taught the other way around almost continuously. I think doing energy early on, And I think a lot of the work that the IOP's done with things like thermal stores and the stores of energy to try and get that change. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, Mark, but the ideas they have about sort of talking about energy stores and transfers between them, which has been sort of pushed a lot here, and all the exam boards have got behind it here, and it's now part of the curriculum. That, I think, actually, the earlier you can teach that, and the earlier you can teach the idea of there's this odd quantity that you can measure that's sort of almost like the fuel tank for anything that happens, that's quite a useful one.
Yeah, I also think it's unfortunate, too, when talking about energy, that force gets wrapped into that simply as the thing that does work.
Yes. Yeah. It's because this is the thing. I mean, what the IOP's energy store thing, I think, did was played down the role of energy, which it needed to be, because its energy is just this sort of slightly odd quantity that we calculate that kind of tells you what you can and cannot do. It's sort of like the cash in the bank. And as we all know, it's not the cash you have in the bank, it's what you do with it that makes the difference. And of course, so forces are in many ways much more important than energy. But I think having a grounding in the idea that there are different types of energy that will fuel the things that happen in the universe is quite an interesting concept, and it's quite a intuitive concept, I think, for young minds to get around their head around. But that's just my intuition. I have no evidence to back that up. I'm sure there is evidence out there to say why energy is well taught like this, but I'm going to stop there because I'm going to get myself in trouble.
Yeah, I fear we should probably wrap it up.
Ooh, that's a shame, actually, because Mark, you'll have to come back for episode two, because I think there's loads of things we could ask, and I'm sure we'll get loads of people asking us, "Oh, what about what happens in America with this? What happens in America with that?" So we should do that. Do this again.
Well, I didn't mean to preempt your future show.
No, it's good to get a link into Teaching Momentum, and if people want to share ideas for Teaching Momentum, they can tweet at PhysicsTP with the hashtag TPTPMomentum.
Yes, or you can get in touch with us on Instagram, of course, physics_teaching_podcast.
You can email us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
Or on our website, there is a contact form on every single page.
It's almost as if we'd done that before. Well, Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure getting you on. I hope we'll get you on again when we've got some more intelligent questions for you. So thank you very much for your time.
It's been wonderful. And, you know, next time I'm in the UK, I'll buy you some fish and chips and a pint.
Great. We'll make sure we wear our bowler hats.
Yes, it's all we eat.
And thank you, Robin.
No worries, Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast, and special thanks this week to Mark Hannam. The podcast is presented by Robin Griffiths and me, Thomas WP, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.